Senator Angus King on the federal government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Senator King's frustration with certain aspects of the federal pandemic response has made national news, especially the lack of a large-scale effective testing system. But King has been focusing on other aspects of the COVID-19 crisis as well, including the future of the U.S. Postal Service, elements of the CARES Act that he believes benefit the super rich, and whether states must share in the costs of FEMA. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, Senator King joins us to discuss the federal response to COVID-19, what worries him most, and how he believes the country can recover economically without risking more lives. And of course, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for Senator King? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Senator Angus King joins us today to talk about the federal government's response to the pandemic. Senator King sits on four oversight committees: Rules, Intelligence, Armed Services, and Energy and Natural Resources. He is also part of the administration's Economic Recovery Task Force. Senator King, welcome back to Maine Calling.
I'm delighted to be with you. I'm on my way up to the third floor, Jennifer, because Mary's on a conference call in the kitchen. So we're dividing the house up in terms of doing the work that we're doing here today. Glad to be with you.
Just like so many American families, as always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What would you like to see the federal government do or continue to do to help those affected by the pandemic? What are your questions for Senator King? You can send an email, and please make it brief, to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Are you there? Are you on the third floor?
I'm here. I'm ready.
Excellent. Well, Senator King, as a former governor, you have a perspective that many of your colleagues do not. And I'm wondering what you think of the plan that Governor Mills laid out yesterday. It's different phases. It's been described as cautious. Do you think that she's laying out something similar to what you would have done in the same circumstance?
Well, the last thing I want to do is second guess one of my successors. She and I have been in close touch. We're probably in touch pretty much every day. And I think what she's done makes a lot of sense. It's uncharted territory, Jennifer. And what you're really doing is weighing economic costs and economic disruption against illness and human lives. We've had a relatively low impact of this disease in Maine, in part because of the early and pretty aggressive, stay-at-home orders that the governor put in place back in March. The real challenge is we have these low numbers, and I'm afraid people may say, well, we have low numbers. Why don't we just open up? We're going to be okay. And that could be the worst thing, where we end up having another spike. And it's particularly complicated because of our destination for people from all over the country and all over the world who could be bringing the disease in with them. So I think my expectation is that what the governor's going to do is watch the data, watch the science, and adjust the plan as time goes on. And that's what people are doing across the country that I think are doing it right. But generally, I think the plan that she set forth yesterday makes a lot of sense.
You and dozens of others of senators and congresspeople are serving on the president's Economic Recovery Task Force. As we move into the next phase of this pandemic, when the focus, as we've mentioned, is on reopening, what is your biggest concern? What keeps you up at night? Is it the idea that there might be a second spike?
Well, what's bothering me most about the current situation is the lack of testing. And this goes back to the question about the governor's orders. If we had a much more vigorous and active testing program, more widespread, we'd know better how to control this without the blunt instrument of asking everyone to stay home. If you think of it this way, we're asking a million people to stay home in order to control the spread of the virus from 1,000. If we knew who the 1,000 were, we could deal with them, treat them, have them isolated, and not have to impact the other 999,000. So that the problem with the federal response, from my point of view, you asked me what keeps me up at night. I literally woke up early this morning. I'm just furious about the lack of an adequate response on the question of testing, and I really don't get it. I don't understand why they're resisting really doing this in a major way. And the other night they had a press conference about testing and the plan, but it was really more aspirational. You know, we're going to do better and we're going to have more tests. But the target is still too low. We're doing about 150 to 200,000 tests a day right now. All the studies and the data that I've looked at tell me that it ought to be more like 1.5 million or 2 million a day, not 200,000. In that way, we could identify who has the disease, who's carrying it, and then we could trace who they saw and who they had contact with. And that's the real way to bring this thing under control. Until we have a vaccine or a cure, which everybody says is unlikely for a year to 18 months, testing and contact tracing is the only tool we have other than the blunt instrument of just everybody staying home. This is an unbelievably contagious disease. And so if you don't have a cure or a vaccine, the only way to stop its spread is to stay away from one another. But that
consequences. You're not the only person completely frustrated with the lack of testing, but how do we get there? I mean, it's one thing to say we want 1 million or 2 million tests a day. What needs to happen, and how soon could it happen realistically?
Well, you mentioned the other, just in your introduction, that I was appointed to the president's task force on reopening. And in my capacity, I sent the president a letter 3 days ago. I haven't publicized it until now, I guess, where I made the argument that I just made about how if you really want to reopen safely, we really need much more extensive testing. And my suggestion was that the president put someone in charge of this who's well-credentialed, has national stature, nonpartisan, and make it happen like the Manhattan Project. My suggestion was Joe Dunford, who was the four-star general that was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the first part of the Trump administration. He's one of the most capable people I've ever met. I didn't consult him, by the way, before I nominated him for this position. But I said to the president, somebody like him, because here's the issue, Jennifer, and the president, I think, has unfairly tried to slip this responsibility onto the states. The states, in fact, do have the responsibility for administering the tests, for giving the tests, whether it's a state, the hospitals, the local health officials. I get that. What the state can't do is create the infrastructure to create the tests themselves and all of the pieces that go into it. It's testing machines, it's swabs, it's vials, it's chemicals, it's wrappers, it's all the pieces that go around it, the labs that analyze the tests. And the federal government has tools to fix the bottlenecks that the states don't have. The states are, you know, they're in the marketplace trying to buy what they need. The federal government can say, we don't have enough vials. The Defense Production Act says I can talk to Corning Glass and say we need 1 million vials. Stop making, fiber optic or whatever you're making and make us vials. That's a power that the president has, going back to World War II. The president also has an overview of the national supply chain and can find out where the bottlenecks are. So to me, it's a partnership, but the key is for the federal government to take on the responsibility of vastly increasing the amount of testing, because if we don't have the testing, then it's really a crapshoot. And the governors are being asked to reopen their economies blindly, just flying blind. And different governors are going to see it differently. Our governor is being conservative about human health. Some other governors may be more prone to say we got to get our economy going again. But the point is, you don't really know how you're doing unless you have the testing. And that's why I'm so fixated on that. So I've tried to make that case directly to the president. I haven't heard back. And I don't know if I will, but to me, this is an obvious management challenge that the administration has the power to really take on in a big way. And for reasons that I honestly don't understand, they just have been reluctant to do so.
That was going to be my follow-up question, whether you'd heard back from the president. Do you believe you will? I mean, the last thing he said out loud about you was that you were worse than any Democrat.
Yeah, that was... you know, that was because I got frustrated on a call with the vice president about 10 days ago, where the call went on for an hour. It just happened that I was lined up to be one of the last people to question. And I had a question prepared about oversight of the CARES Act and nothing to do with testing. But he'd been asked four or five questions and really hadn't answered them, hadn't talked about a specific plan or goals or metrics or, you know, what we were doing. And I just lost it at the end of the call and said, you know, this, your failure to do this is a dereliction of duty. And I think it sort of took the vice president aback. And obviously the word got, I didn't publicize it. Somebody on the call did. I went about my business that afternoon, but it got back to the president. He took me on in his press conference Saturday night. But, you know, what the heck? I'm going to say what I think is important. And, you know, whether that incident will prejudice the president's response to what I said. But, you know, I'm giving him a chance to be a hero. I mean, if he picks this up and has a dramatic press conference and says, we are going to treat this like the Manhattan Project and we're going to go to a million or million and a half or 2 million tests a day, and I put Joe Dunford in charge, or, you know, I don't know who else, Bill Gates or somebody who's well known and has that kind of stature, I think people would respond. I think people would say, oh, well, this administration is really getting on top of this thing. But instead, they keep doing these sort of half measures that just aren't adequate.
Speaking of letters, you've also sent a letter to the Treasury Secretary about the U.S. Postal Service. You're frustrated that part of the CARES Act is a $10 billion loan to the Postal Service and that's not being released. What can you as a senator do to make sure that that is released?
Well, you know, the money was in the CARES Act because of the special strain on the post office that this has created, as it has on a lot of other institutions. And what we were really talking about was helping them over the hump on their operational expenses between now and the end of the year. And the Treasury Department and the president appear to be imposing conditions on the loan, which I don't think are, it certainly wasn't contemplated by Congress, and I don't think are relevant to what we're trying to do here. There are legitimate questions about how the post office prices stamps and letters and junk mail and I shouldn't say junk mail, you know, flyers and packages. There, you know, those are all questions, but this isn't the place to resolve that. We want the post office to be in business so they can deliver the vital materials to people all over the country, whether it's Social Security checks or you name it. And that's what this is all about. The president is fixated on the cost of shipping packages, and he keeps talking about Amazon, which he doesn't like very much, in part because the owner of Amazon also owns the Washington Post. And I've actually done some research on that, and it's very complicated. But if it weren't for the package business, the post office would be in much worse financial shape, because, as everybody knows, with email and texts, first-class mail has dropped dramatically, and the package delivery business, which the post office has gotten into in a big way, has really helped to keep them afloat financially. Now, whether the rate ought to be $2 a package or $1.78 or $2.42, I don't know. There's an independent postal board that's supposed to make those kinds of decisions, not presidents or senators or members of Congress, and I think that process ought to be allowed to play out rather than trying to use this emergency loan as leverage to get other policy changes at the post office that, you know, they need to be debated and decided. But I want to be sure somebody's going to be there to deliver the mail in the fall.
Another item that you've been active on is co-sponsoring a bill looking at a millionaire tax break in the CARES legislation. Tell me what you found and what the chances are of getting that repealed or taken out.
Well, this is one of those things, you know, when you do a bill of this magnitude in a very short period of time, and in this case, the short period of time was necessary. I mean, we had to get the money out to help keep the economy afloat. We were within weeks of just a catastrophe, and it's pretty bad as it is. But in it, tucked into it, in the bill that was originally presented by Senator McConnell, was a major tax break that allowed certain taxpayers, to carry back losses for up to, I think, 5 years, which will have the effect. The estimate is it'll cost the Treasury something like $190 billion over the next 10 years, which is, you know, that's a gigantic amount of money. That's more money, by the way, than is going out to the hospitals under this legislation. And I can't remember the exact figures, but something like 90% of it will go to people in the upper 1% of the tax bracket. And that just struck me as wrong. I mean, that should not have been in this bill. It was only after the bill passed that the full implications of it in terms of its cost were realized. You see a change like that and you say, well, that doesn't seem like a big deal. But the Joint Committee on Taxation came out with an estimate after the bill passed that said, you know, this is in the almost $200 billion worth of cost. So I weighed in on that. I mean, that just seems wrong to me. I don't know whether we're going to be able to reverse it, whether Senator McConnell will entertain an amendment, but it seems to me there are some ways to control that so it doesn't disproportionately benefit people that don't really need it.
Senator King, you've been an advocate for better and stronger broadband throughout Maine, especially the rural areas, for years. Do you see a way that this pandemic, this crisis, which has so magnified the difference between people who have broadband and don't, will be a step towards solving the problem?
Yes. How's that for a short answer? Yes. There's no question. My wife, Mary, has been working on connectivity for students. And, you know, a lot of our students, I don't know the exact number, maybe 20% or more, don't have acceptable broadband or internet service at home. So trying to homeschool remotely online during this period has been very difficult because everybody doesn't have equal access. And it has really underlined that. The other way it has, Jennifer, is the importance of broadband for working from home. We have companies in Maine. Stop and think for a minute the economic effect of what we're going through now if we didn't have the technology to work from home. We've got companies in Maine that are, I think Unum is an example, where the vast majority of the people are working from home. So they're still working, they're still drawing their salaries, they're still contributing to the economy. Without this technology, they wouldn't be able to do that. And the unemployment problem, the cost, the economic damage would be even greater than it is today. And it's pretty bad right now. So that's underlined the disparity of broadband access across the state. We have pretty good access in southern Maine and most of the more urbanized communities, but there are parts of Maine that are broadband deserts, and that severely limits not only kids, you know, being able to connect with their school, but it limits people being able to work from home. It limits the economic opportunity in those communities. And as you know, I've been working on this. I'm the co-chair, I guess, of the Senate Broadband Caucus, which is made up of representative senators, bipartisan, from places like Arkansas and West Virginia, the Dakotas, Montana, and Nebraska. This is a huge problem across the country. And to go back to your question, the short answer is I think this pandemic has really brought it into focus. for everybody, bipartisan, and hopefully it will be part of, well, I'll tell you what, they're talking about an infrastructure bill for highways. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not on board with any infrastructure bill unless it includes a major section for broadband.
I know that there's been, you have supported treating broadband like America treated the Rural Electrification Act so many years ago. And I'm wondering, I know that there's been a lot of resistance to this, a lot of resistance among some to even call broadband a utility. Are you hearing a different discussion now? Do you believe that this is changing the way people perceive of broadband?
I think it is. And I think people are realizing it's not a luxury and it's not something that that rich people use or, it's sort of fun. It's a basic element of our economy. It's a basic element of our education. And it was before, it was important in education even before the pandemic because we call it the homework gap. Kids were being sent home. And one of my big colleagues on this subject is Shelley Moore Capito, this Republican senator from West Virginia. She and I have been doing things on the homework gap for the past 4 or 5 years. It's the disparity of kids going home and not being able to access the internet and complete their assignments. But I do think that what's happened in the last 2 months has really brought home to people how important it is. Here's the other piece is telemedicine and access to health care in rural areas. I was on a call an hour ago with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, and one of the very first questions, interesting, from a Republican senator was, why are you reimbursing at such a low rate for telehealth in rural areas when low-income and particularly elderly people can't get into the hospital? They have to do telehealth, but you're only paying, you know what they're paying the provider for that phone call? $12. Mm. And that doesn't in any way near reimburse them for the true cost of providing that service. So, and that was Jerry Moran's question. He's a Republican senator from Kansas, is why aren't we addressing this issue? So this is healthcare, it's education, it's economics, and as you can tell, I'm almost as wound up as I was on the call with the vice president. this is something we've got to address.
Well, we are speaking with Senator Angus King. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Mechanical Services, committed to providing Maine healthcare facilities with efficient HVAC systems, building controls, and service. And Maine Community Foundation, working with donors to expedite funding to nonprofits in this unprecedented time. Learn more at mainecf.org.
He has a severely compromised immune system. She goes to work in an emergency room. So now they are living under the same roof, 6 feet apart.
My fear is infecting you, even if I wasn't showing any symptoms at all.
Yeah, I understand why that would worry you. That worries me.
How the coronavirus pandemic has upended life at home this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Trusted news, quality entertainment, and lifelong learning is what Maine Public Television is all about, 4 channels strong. And a reminder about the new daytime educational fair from science to nature to history programming for the older kids at home. We have the PBS Kids channel for preschool kids, but our main channel has more afternoon programming for older learners, starting at 1 each afternoon. And the Maine Public World channel is offering the same each weekday afternoon from 12 to 5. Television programming that is worthwhile and educational to watch. See the schedule for our main HD and World channels at mainepublic.org. Click on the television drop-down.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Senator Angus King is our guest. He is in his second term as U.S. Senator and is serving on the administration's task force to reopen the economy. What questions do you have about the work of the federal government during this pandemic? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, we were talking about broadband. Senator King mentioned telehealth, and I just want to make a note that on Monday, that will be the topic of Maine Calling. We will be talking about telehealth during this pandemic. We're going to go to Michael, who's calling from Kittery. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thanks, Jennifer. Senator Michael Krause, the president of Professional Firefighters of Maine. How you doing?
I'm great, man. Good to hear from you.
Yep. I hope you and Mary are doing well under these challenging conditions. But and listening to the broadcast today, as always, we support your efforts, what you're doing for Maine and the country. And you were right on point with some of the things you and Jennifer were talking about, and we appreciate that. One of the things that are affecting us, our first responders, as you're aware, and I think it was in the Stimulus 3 package, they enhanced or extended the family medical leave benefits. Unfortunately for our healthcare workers and our first responders, we were excluded from that benefit. And I was wondering if there was any way in your busy schedule down there you could take a look at that and see if maybe in Stimulus 4 we can get that turned around. Because the state and some of our employers here in Maine have opted out and not, I mean, the way I guess the statute's written is discretionary that they can or they can't provide the benefit. And on balance, the state and most of our employers have taken a position not to provide that benefit or not to give the healthcare workers and first responders that benefit.
Well, we're going to that is one of the things we're going to work on. As you can imagine, I spend a good deal of my life on conference calls these days, and that's something that's come up. And clearly the first responders are the people that we think should have been beneficiaries of that change. And so I'm hoping maybe that could be part of the next package. I will tell you that what's going to be in the next package, nobody knows right now. It's very much up in the air. But let me just mention one other thing that I know you're going to be interested in, and that is the big issue that's facing us is support for states and local governments who are just being hammered. And what worries me is it's easy for people to say, oh, well, the states, you know, the state is this big sort of abstract entity. No, the state is people. And as you know, in Maine, a lot of the funds that go to the state of Maine end up coming right back to the communities, either in form of revenue sharing or general purpose aid for education. And what worries me is if we can't get some help for the states, that it's going to fall back on the local, on the localities, and that in turn is going to fall back on the first responders. I mean, what could be worse in this situation than a town having to lay off EMT and fire and police because the budgets are being crushed because of this this epidemic? So I want you to keep your eye on that one, and that's one that is going to be a big issue in Washington right now, and it's one, maybe it's because I'm a former governor, but the state is all the states, it's not blue states or red states, all the states are being hammered by a loss of revenue and increased costs due to this epidemic, and it's something that we have to attend to. Otherwise, if we start laying off first responders, we're going to make the whole thing worse. We could turn a recession into a depression, and that's that just doesn't make any sense.
Michael, thanks so much for your call. We have an email here from Lynn. I read recently that the Senate Intelligence Committee released the fourth volume of its review of it Russian interference in the 2016 election. According to the story I read in Politico, you commented that the fifth volume will focus on whether or not there was, in fact, some relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Can you tell us when the fifth volume will be released, and will it be made available to the public?
The answer to the second question is yes, of course, it will be made available. In terms of timing, that's hard to say. This has been a long, painstaking process. The report that we just released was, I think, 180 pages long, although many of them were redacted because of concerns about national security. But the conclusion, I think the important thing, Jennifer, was the conclusion of the committee. And that is that the study that was done by the intelligence community in January of 2017, just before the president took office, that basically said three or four things. It said the Russians interfered in the 2016 election, the Russians. It was at the direction of Vladimir Putin. It was intended to harm Hillary Clinton. And at the end, they developed a preference for candidate Trump. That was the conclusion of the intelligence community in 2017. What we did is went back and plowed all the ground that they went through in terms of raw data, raw intelligence, talked to the analysts, and our committee unanimously, this is important, unanimously endorsed the findings of that original intelligence community report from 3 years ago. And it's, I say it's important because our committee is bipartisan. It's controlled by Republicans. It's majority Republican. And it's not ideologically cross-sectioned from Tom Cotton and John Cornyn to Dianne Feinstein and Ron Wyden. I mean, it sort of covers the waterfront. Susan Collins and I are both on it. But the important part of that report was that it really closes the case on, did the Russians do it? And were they attempting to help candidate Trump? The answer is yes. And then the final piece, as you mentioned, is, was there some relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russians? And I can't comment on that because we're not done yet. When it will be ready, I hope in the next several months. But I can tell you that we're working slowly and painstakingly because we want to try to maintain unanimity as much as we can on the committee. I think that's important. And we want to be sure that we have all the facts. So we've now issued four reports, the fifth and last one. And, you know, the toughest one, frankly, politically, is the one that we're working on right now. But this question of did the Russians do it? That's laid to rest, and in a bipartisan, unanimous finding of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
All right, we're going to move on to Maria, who's calling from Auburn. Hi, Maria. Go ahead. You're on with Senator King.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your time, Senator King. I have a question about the SNAP online purchase program. It was a program before the pandemic started, but now it's expanding. Six states were in pilot for it, but now four new states have signed on. And I was wondering, is there any way that you could reach out to the USDA Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue and see if he would approve the request that Maine could be a part of this pilot program so SNAP people could use their card to for online purchases during this coronavirus pandemic?
I think that's a sensible idea, and the answer is yes, I will reach out. I talked to Secretary Perdue about 5 days ago about something else. I've gotten to know him. He's a former governor. We have this little society of former governors, and I will raise that issue with him. I thank you for bringing that up. I wasn't aware of where that stood at the present time, but given where we are now in terms of going to the store, it certainly makes sense. So I'll take that up. Thank you.
Thanks, Maria, for your call. We'll move on to Scott, who's calling from Harpswell. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer, and thanks, Senator King. I've worked for a while on researching the importance of post offices in rural areas, and Maine being the most rural state. We have a lot of special needs, from knowing that people who are in a remote part of our states would face really high surcharges from FedEx and UPS if the post office went away and would have trouble getting their drugs and maybe their ballots. And it's also a really important employer in the state. There's more than 3,000 postal workers in the state, which is more than the number of construction workers. So I'm wondering what you think the prospects are for getting postal relief without huge strings attached, as the Treasury is proposing in the loan you talked about earlier, and what we can do to help move that along so we can protect our public post office.
Well, listen, you just made the case, and you know better than I how important those rural post offices are for all the reasons you mentioned, and that's why I joined in the letter to the Treasury Secretary saying, you know, let's do the loan that was authorized in the law, and not try to use it as a backdoor way of getting policy changes that you or the president or someone else may want. So what are the chances? I don't know. I couldn't give you odds on it because the administration, you know, the law does say that it can be subject to conditions, but I just reread it last night. It says, subject to conditions as might be agreed between the Postal Service and the Treasury Department, mutually agreed. So if they if the Treasury Department tries to impose conditions that are really at variance with current policy, I would think that the Postal Service wouldn't agree and that should be the end of it, and the Treasury should issue the money. But I'm worried about it, and you get into this situation where, you know, you have to sue the Treasury Department to do what the law says, and who sues and who has standing and all of those kinds of things. But hopefully an outcry from the country, and again, we're talking about a short-term loan to get us through this crisis into the next year, and that really should be a vehicle for trying to do all kinds of other agendas. I hope that Secretary Mnuchin will see the light on that, and we can move beyond this issue. But you're right, and I wish, by the way, you would share your data. You said you've done a lot of research. Please share your data if you haven't already with my office. Because I'd love to see it. It'll add ammunition to the work that I'm already doing on this.
Scott, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions for Senator Angus King. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Waterville Creates, inviting you to support the arts today with a donation at watervillecreates.org. And Pharma, America's biopharmaceutical companies committed to beating the coronavirus. Updates from these companies are available at pharma.org/coronavirus.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Maynard John Noble Goodwin died on April 29, 1887. Born in South Berwick in 1824, he graduated from Dartmouth College in 1844, studied law, was admitted to the bar in 1848, and commenced to practice law in Maine. He was a member of the Maine State Senate and was elected as a Republican to the 37th Congress. After his term, he was appointed by President Lincoln as Chief Justice of the Arizona Territory, and in December 1863, he was appointed the first Arizona Territory Governor, serving until 1866.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine!
The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus usually takes place at about 2 each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is scheduled for 2 weekday afternoons and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking with Senator Angus King about the federal government's response to the coronavirus crisis. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll move on to Peter, who's calling from Cape Cod. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Senator, getting back to the testing, I have a recommendation for you. I would put General McChrystal, Stanley McChrystal, in charge of that campaign. I think he's well organized. He's already shown or demonstrated that he's actively trying to seek a solution, advising people, including the mayor of Boston. But also with respect to broadband, more importantly, I used to do a lot of writing for the Bangor Daily News about broadband. I remember a big event we had at the Spectacular Events Center concerning broadband. I was one of the speakers. It just so happens there's an interesting coincidence unfolding. Elon Musk has his Starlink satellites now. An adequate number of them, 400, are in orbit. It'll allow him to go forward with a beta test of the broadband that he wants to bring to not just North America and the United States, but worldwide.
Sure, Peter. I'm going to give the senator a chance to respond. We have lots of calls coming in. Go ahead, Senator King.
Well, I think the point Peter makes is important, and that is that there's no single answer to the question of broadband. And there's all kinds of technology going on now, from what Elon Musk is talking about with satellites to 5G to fiber to the home, which communities in Maine are doing on their own. And as my philosophy is, you know, let's bring it on. Let's try as many solutions as we can to try to find what will work economically, particularly for our rural areas. And as far as this suggestion about General McChrystal, absolutely. Somebody of that stature is exactly who I think the president should put in charge of this this testing challenge. And let's get it done. I always used to say to people when they say, oh, it's going to take a couple of years, I'd say, listen, Eisenhower took Europe in 11 months. So don't tell me it's going to take 2 or 3 years. And let's get this done. This ought to be done in a matter of weeks.
Peter, thanks for your call. I'm going to go to an email from Melody. What can Senator King tell us about his or other legislators' efforts to secure CARES Act funds for Calais Regional Hospital?
Well, interesting. I've been on the phone several times in the last couple of weeks with Jim Thompson, who's an old friend of mine. This is the way Maine is. I married he and Judy here in Brunswick when they lived here, and now he lives in Calais and is on the board of the hospital. They got the first round of CARES Act funding about 2 weeks ago, which came in the nick of time, and there should be another round coming in the next few days. The other thing that I've tried to work on for them is the eligibility for the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP program, which the SBA wrongly, I think, excluded them because they were in a bankruptcy reorganization, a Chapter 11 reorganization, and they said, well, if you're in a bankruptcy, we can't do this. That's nowhere in the law, and I had a teleconference with the head of the SBA in Washington on that subject, and they've been sort of mulling it. I don't like the direction that they're going in. But the answer is both my staff and I, Chris Rector up the coast, and I have been very directly involved in trying to help the Calais Hospital, and they should be getting another hunk of money from the CARES Act very soon, if it hasn't arrived already. A bunch of us were on a conference call with the Secretary of Health and Human Services just this morning, and that was the subject of the call. And my understanding is that money should be going out, especially directed to the rural hospitals, which should help places like Penobscot Valley and Calais and all of our smaller hospitals around the state. They've been particularly hard hit in this situation.
Pat on Facebook asks, I have been distressed by watching the destruction of food caused by the supply line disruptions during this pandemic. I grew up with my family using the Federal Surplus Foods Program, and it was invaluable to our well-being. Would you please work with Maine's other representatives to get a similar program that would distribute rather than destroy very needed food?
Great point. And I remember when I worked in Somerset County, how important the surplus food program was to just many, many people. And yeah, it's heartbreaking to see on the news milk being, you know, poured down a drain. That's the kind of thing that the Department of Agriculture is working on. I think one of the problems, Jennifer, is that this problem hit us so fast. I mean, I don't want to get into the question of, you know, what did the president know and when did he know it, but I'm talking about the real impact on farmers and schools and businesses really happened in a very short period of time. And so there are these huge disruptions in supply chains and in demand. For example, here's a good example. We make, as you know, in Rustic County, potatoes are a big deal, and we make millions of French fries. Well, the French fry market went down because restaurants are closed, and so suddenly that's an example of how this kind of thing sort of flows backwards, and we're scrambling to try to get caught up. But I agree with the Facebook post that certainly one way to do this is for the Department of Agriculture to move these commodities to places where they're needed, and they sure are needed at food banks in Maine, I can tell you that.
We'll go to Rebecca, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Senator King, I wondered if you could tell me something that I took to understand as truth, but I want to just run it by you. Is it true that one of the reasons we do not have adequate testing for COVID-19 is because our situation is that our president says that we have to use American-made tests as opposed to other countries' tests that are readily available?
I have not heard that. As I said earlier, I've been puzzled by the failure of the administration to really jump on this as the best interim solution pending a vaccine. But I have not heard that. On the other hand, I think now we ought to be getting whatever supplies we can from wherever they're available. But I think this whole situation has demonstrated the danger of supply chain, international supply chain for critical materials, something that, you know, you absolutely need in an emergency. I think we've learned that having ourselves in the hands of other countries who might cut off those supplies for whatever reason is dangerous. But no, I can't verify that this is because of the president's unwillingness. I think it's actually a matter more of the complexity of everything from chemicals to vials to swabs to you name it. This is a really tough management challenge, and I just don't think the administration has risen to that challenge. For some reason, they just haven't. And give me a target. I mean, it seems to me you should start with, okay, how many do we need? And we need a lot more than 400,000 a day, I'll tell you that. But one of my principles is if you don't have a destination, you never get there. And so I would start with the definition of how many do we need? And I think the number is between a million and 2 million a day in order to effectively get a hold of this. And then we can go back from there and say, okay, that means we need this many vials, this many swabs, this much chemical, this much lab capacity, and build it given the authorities and power that the federal government has. So I can't confirm that what you heard, but I can confirm that we're not doing nearly enough. And it, as I mentioned before, it leaves us in a situation of reopening the economy blindly without really fully being aware of what the risks are.
Rebecca, thanks for your question. An email from Jim. I'm concerned about the actions being taken by the administration quietly in the background. In early April, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission announced an interpretation so that it doesn't require a legal process. The impact of their action is to attempt to deregulate the disposal of low-level radioactive waste and allow these wastes to be buried in unlicensed landfills all over the country. The comment period has already ended, and the NRC is poised to take the final action. All this was done while our attention, rightly, was on the looming COVID challenge. Is there a way to put businesses on notice that these sleight-of-hand rule changes will be reconsidered at some future point? For that matter, is there a way to reconsider them?
And the answer is yes. Congress has a power called it's a CRA. It's the Congressional Review Act, where within, I think it's 90 days of the finalization of any federal regulation, Congress can stop it. And it's a simple majority in both houses. And this, the one this caller mentioned, frankly, I had not heard about, but that's the kind of thing that we do have the power to take up. And it's a privileged motion, so the leadership can't squash it as they can many other things. So that's one option. The other, and there have been a number of these kinds of regulatory changes that I think have been very damaging. The other is, I think, frankly, they ought to pause in these kinds of actions pending the resolution of the current crisis. We should not be taking major policy actions that are flying under the everybody's knowledge at a time like this. And I agree that's the kind of thing. And it's not the only one, by the way, that there have been some changes in the rule about automobile emission standards, for example, or mileage standards that have long-term and big significance, both in terms of health and in terms of cost to drivers that have been made in the last couple of months. That's the kind of thing. I don't think they should be doing it, but if they are, we do have an opportunity in Congress. We need a majority. So in the Senate, it has to be bipartisan, but we do have a chance to change some of these things.
Senator King, we have just a couple minutes left, but I understand you've been doing teleconferences across the state with different groups of people. Are there any themes that you're finding, especially those that might be surprising you a little bit?
Well, there have been lots of questions about the PPP program and how it's working and in some cases how it's not working. It's been very successful. It's brought a lot of money into Maine and a lot of money into Maine businesses. But for some businesses, it hasn't worked. So there was some sort of technical issues about that. It's also one of the major changes in the CARES Act was an expansion of unemployment insurance in order to ease the impact of this crisis. And it's been slow to be implemented, not because the state of Maine or the state of New Jersey or Alabama have been slow, but because this Washington, the federal Department of Labor, has been slow to provide the guidance. And that's something that I'm hearing, because that was designed to be, you know, emergency aid to keep people on their feet. And here we are. It's been about a month since the CARES Act passed. And I think I read today that the state expanded unemployment will be online day after tomorrow, this Friday. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that I'm hearing. But I'm also hearing great heartwarming stories of people stepping up and helping their neighbors and doing the right thing. Here's one I just heard about last night. One of the bottlenecks in the testing program is swabs, the little swabs that you put in your nose and a test to find out whether you have this disease. There's a company in Maine, Puritan, up in Guilford, that makes those. They're running absolutely flat out, and they don't have the capacity to make more because they don't have the machines. Bath Ironworks sent a group of engineers up there, studied their machines, reverse engineered them, and are building additional machines down in Bath to make the swabs to help us through this crisis in testing. So that's a story of a Maine company stepping up and really doing something that could be important for the whole country. That's a big story, but then, you know, there are individual stories everywhere of people pitching in and supporting one another, individuals buying gift cards at restaurants to keep them afloat.
Senator King, this is a wonderful and positive way to end the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Call your local restaurant for takeout dinner tonight. That'll help the Maine economy.
Senator Angus King on Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.